This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed. and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, he named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Australia announces a deal to buy U.S. nuclear-powered submarines, calling it the biggest single investment ever in the country's defense capability. North Korea test fires two short-range ballistic missiles one day after the U.S. and South Korea kicked off their large-scale joint military drills. And Cyclone Freddy kills around 100 people in Malawi, prompting authorities to declare a state of disaster in several regions. Thanks for joining us. Australia has announced plans to buy five U.S. nuclear-powered submarines as part of a Western push to contain China's growing influence in the Asia-Pacific. The Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese made the announcement, calling it the biggest single investment ever in his country's defense capability. Albanese was speaking at an event at an American naval base in California, where U.S. President Joe Biden also hosted British Premier Rishi Sunak. Biden's national security advisor said the first deliveries of submarines to Canberra will be made in the 2030s. The deal is part of a three-way security pact signed by the U.S., Britain, and Australia in 2021, also known as AUKUS. Biden has clarified that American submarines to Australia would be nuclear-powered, not nuclear-armed.
These subs are powered, not nuclear-armed subs. They're nuclear-powered. Non-nuclear armed. Australia is a proud non-nuclear weapon state and is committed to stay that way. These boats will not have any nuclear weapons of any kind.
Biden said the submarine deal was a game changer concerning what he called peace in the Asia Pacific in a jab at China's military expansion. The Chinese Foreign Ministry hit back, accusing Australia, the U.S., and Britain of setting off an arms race and undermining nuclear non-proliferation efforts. Beijing says the Western countries should abandon their Cold War mentality and adopt measures conducive to international peace. North Korea has fired two more ballistic missiles as South Korea and the U.S. are conducting their biggest war games in years. According to the South Korean military, the short-range missiles were launched into the sea off the North's east coast. The military said it maintained full readiness posture in close coordination with the U.S. Meanwhile, Seoul said its joint drills with Washington would continue as planned. The 11-day war games started on Monday to counter what the two allies are calling Pyongyang's growing threats. Japan, another U.S. ally, has reacted to North Korea's latest launch. Tokyo says that it will continue to cooperate closely with Seoul and Washington as it warns of further potential provocation by Pyongyang.
As we have stated in the past, we think there's a possibility that North Korea will step up further provocative actions, including missile launches and conducting nuclear tests.
North Korea's missile launch comes 2 days after the country test-fired two cruise missiles from a submarine. Pyongyang also on Sunday said that it has decided to take, quote, important practical war deterrence measures. North Korea has carried out a slew of missile tests in the past year, response to frequent U.S.-led military drills around the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang regards those military exercises a show of muscle flexing and rehearsals for an invasion. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, earlier joined us with more details on North Korea's latest missile launches.
As the U.S. is kind of defaulting to a hawkish South Korean position, the U.S. does see advantages to this, certainly in terms of its desire to expand its regional footprint and kind of keep its sort of pressure on China. And it views perhaps North Korea's, you know, development of nuclear weapons, development of missiles to deliver nuclear weapons as a means of justifying bringing more weapons into the region, militarizing its relations with South Korea and Japan as a way to, again, contain China. So while the U.S., you know, in some respects is kind of exercising a default policy in terms of South Korea, it is taking advantage in a way vis-a-vis China.
Nearly 100 people have been killed in Malawi as a cyclone returns to southern Africa's mainland. Officials say they expect the number to rise, with 16 people still missing. At least 10 other people died in neighboring Mozambique. Packing powerful winds and torrential rain, Cyclone Freddy is on track to become the longest-lasting storm on record. It barreled through southern Africa at the weekend for the second time within a few weeks. It has wreaked widespread havoc, triggering mudslides, flight cancellations, and even fears of the spread of waterborne diseases like cholera. The Malawian president has declared a state of disaster in several southern regions. Palestinians in Gaza have held a rally to mark the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. They paid homage to tens of thousands of Palestinians injured by Israeli attacks. Ashraf Shannon has more.
People in the Gaza Strip rallied in front of the Red Cross office on Monday to mark this year's Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to Palestinians who have got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffer from permanent disabilities caused by Israel. Wounded Palestinians say Israel's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as the regime is under the protection of Western countries.
Our injuries always remind us of the criminal Zionist enemy who left us scarred for life. The Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people started in 1948 and continue to take place until this day. The world, especially the Western countries, must stop assisting the Israeli regime.
During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including women and children, and injured more than 11,000. In May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women. The wounded people in Gaza are also suffering from the Israeli blockade, which has created a harsh humanitarian situation in the region.
Gaza Strip, during the last years, witnessed different escalation, which caused so many wounded people who are suffering due to their injuries, severe injuries, and in the same time, the socioeconomic conditions due to the blockade.
Wounded Palestinians in the blockaded territory struggled to cope with their injuries due to a lack of specialized medical facilities to cater for their needs.
We are calling on the international community in order to exert the pressure on Israel, first to stop its offensive on the Palestinian people, and also to end this illegal blockade, to let end the medical instruments and equipments and medicine to Gaza Strip in order to help these people who are in bad need for surgeries and medical treatments.
Medics say Israel's use of unconventional weapons during its wars and aggressions has increased the number of severe injuries among Palestinians.
Israeli regime forces have killed and maimed thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, including women and children, since 2008. Experts say the international community must end its apathy to Israeli crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
David Miller is a pro-Palestinian activist and a former professor at the British University of Bristol, whose anti-Zionist stance caused him to be expelled from the university in 2021. He says Western spy agencies and their media outlets are behind the unrest and subversions in the countries they deem to be enemies. Saman Kujuri reports.
A leading critic of Israeli aggression against Palestinians, David Miller, who was sacked from his professorship at the University of Bristol in 2021 after a sustained campaign by Britain's Israel lobby targeting him, has addressed a group of Iranian students at the IRIB University in Tehran. He said Western spy agencies in association with the Western media outlets are to be blamed for unrests and riots in various countries, including Syria.
And MI6 also played a key role in the creation of the Free Syria Army and what was termed in British propaganda terms the moderate armed opposition in Syria. And the most shocking thing, I think, is the involvement in the managed massacre of captives in order to present evidence of chemical weapons attacks by the Syrian government.
Moreover, Miller said that the recent unrests, which erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime.
The hybrid war strategy against Iran, against so many other enemy states, is led by the United States via a myriad of assets and outlets. One of the key elements is what might be called the small media strategy. U.S. funds are channeled directly and indirectly to a variety of independent media and citizen journalism or media defense organizations.
Miller, who is also the producer of Palestine Declassified show on Press TV, has repeatedly come under attack by Israeli lobbies in the UK for supporting Palestine and revealing the true face of Israeli regime and its Western allies.
Although David Miller has been sacked from university and has been repeatedly pressured by Israeli lobbies, and there are efforts underway to undermine and smear his name and reputation, he believes such attacks will simply strengthen his resolve to continue the fight. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for an alliance among countries sanctioned by the U.S. to defeat the coercive ploy. The leader says if the countries that have been sanctioned by the U.S. tap into each other's capacities, they will all reap the benefits. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Belarusian president. The leader said tough sanctions turned Iran's attention inward and paved the way for great progress for the country. The leader also called for drastic expansion of ties between Tehran and Minsk, saying the two sides have the will and the spirit to implement bilateral agreements. For his part, Alexander Lukashenko said that his visit is aimed at opening a new chapter in bilateral ties and witnessing firsthand Iran's achievements despite years of sanctions. Iran and Belarus have agreed on a roadmap to boost political and economic relations. This follows high-level discussions between Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko and Iranian officials in Tehran. Gisumi Shahmeri has the details.
A comprehensive cooperation roadmap aimed at expanding bilateral relations and 7 MOUs to boost trade and cooperation in transportation, agricultural and cultural fields. The result of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko's two-day visit to Tehran, celebrating three decades of close ties between Iran and Belarus.
The visit can be considered a turning point in our bilateral relations. It's an opportunity to share our experiences. We have made remarkable progress despite the sanctions, and we have turned threats into opportunities. We are ready to share our experiences with our friend Belarus.
We're both on the same page. We both agree that a multipolar world is emerging. Iran has made great achievements despite Western sanctions and has turned into an important player in the region and the international arena. There's a lot that we can do together.
The high-level talks between the two sides also included a pledge to increase trade volume to $100 million per year.
Both countries are determined to improve their relations and trade. The economic relations between Iran and Belarus are not comparable to the past.
This is a third visit ever to Tehran by a Belarusian president and the first in 17 years.
Belarus and Iran enjoy strong relations, which is reflected in frequent high-level meetings and various agreements. Belarusian officials have described Iran as a strong partner for their country in the region and in the world. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
U.S. President Joe Biden says that his country's banking system is safe in the wake of a sudden collapse of two American banks, which has sparked fears of contagion in the financial sector.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed. On top of all, let's also take a look at a moment.
Biden also pledged stiffer bank regulations, forcing regulators to step in with a series of emergency measures. Collapse of Silicon Valley Bank on Friday was followed by the shutdown of Signature Bank in New York on Sunday, prompting a plunge in U.S. bank shares. Concerns are growing that it would affect a large number of American technology and healthcare companies, as well as startups, if they cannot access their money. The losses have also reached major lenders in Asia, with HSBC, National Australia Bank, and Mitsubishi UFJ bearing the brunt. Public sector strikes continue to rock the UK economy. The latest action is a three-day walkout by tens of thousands of junior doctors in a dispute with the government over pay, privatization, and a lack of resources. The move is likely to affect 500,000 hospital appointments. Said Puriza has more from London.
Overworked, underpaid, and burdened with student loans. A situation facing tens of thousands of junior doctors on a three-day strike across England. Ada is a trainee anesthetist in London on $23 an hour.
For this amount of money, I'm struggling with everyday expenses like rent and travel, and there's not much that I can save, even though I feel like I live quite frugally in London.
Some are even worse off. When they start out in the profession, junior doctors are paid nearly $17 an hour, a rate they say does not keep pace with the double-digit inflation.
Financial struggles and burnout is forcing many doctors out of the NHS that's already grappling with a record-high patient waiting list. It's more than 7 million people as of January this year.
And today's action means hundreds of thousands of cancelled appointments across the country.
Ultimately, it is patients that have to deal with the consequences of this. We're having 500 patients every single week die in the NHS unnecessarily due to a lack of staff, a lack of doctors.
All of that, the doctors say, a result of a tough pandemic period, underfunding, and a more than 25% cut to their take-home pay over 15 years that has left them demoralized. The walkout by junior doctors, who make up around 40% of the medical force, comes on the heels of a wave of industrial action by nurses, ambulance workers, and other staff. The government says the 35% pay demand from the doctors is unaffordable.
The cost of pay restoration for junior doctors is approximately £1 billion. The government has spent at least £4 billion on PPE that was unusable and had to be burned. So it's simply not true that this is an unaffordable ask. It was affordable in 2008. It should be affordable in 2023.
On the eve of the stoppage, the government offered to talk if the walkout was cancelled. Unions such as the British Medical Association are warning the strikes could continue into next year unless their demands are met. Saeed Puriza, London.
France's aviation authority has urged companies to cancel flights ahead of strikes against the government's pension reform plan. The Directorate General for Civil Aviation asked airlines to cut back their schedule of planned flights from Paris Orly Airport by 20%. It warned of widespread disruptions due to air traffic controllers' walkout on Tuesday. France has seen months of strikes and protests across various sectors over the pension reform. President Emmanuel Macron plans to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, arguing that it is the only way to prevent the collapse of the current system. Opponents, however, see the changes as unfair. The Senate has already approved the plan, but a final vote is still required by both chambers of Parliament. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
An analyst known for accurately predicting past crises has claimed that a recent spate of failures in the US portends economic trouble and bank and cryptocurrency failures ahead. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted Stephanie Pombey, the U.S. economist known for her predictions of America's early 2000s housing bubble and the 2008 global financial collapse, has sounded the alarm on a recent spate of bank and cryptocurrency failures that could be just the beginning of another cascading crisis in the U.S. What we are facing right now is really serious, Pombey, founder of economic research firm Macro Maven, said recently in a Fox News interview, adding, "We are on the brink of a 2008-style financial crisis." She made her assessment in the wake of the recent shutdown of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, by federal regulators, the second largest failure in U.S. banking history. SVB's collapse came on the heels of this week's closure of cryptocurrency lender Silvergate Bank, as well as the bankruptcies last fall of crypto firms FTX, BlockFi, and Three Arrows Capital. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen issued a statement recently declaring that the U.S. banking system remains resilient and regulators have effective tools to address this type of event. Pombey was unconvinced, mocking Yellen for an absolutely insane focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion at a time when rapid increases in interest rates by the U.S. Federal Reserve are exposing the fragility of the nation's debt-laden financial system. The economy said, "Look, you don't raise rates in record fashion on an economy touting record leverage at maximum speculation and expect no consequences." Adding, "This was clearly going to happen, and now we are seeing the weak links in the chain break. The areas where speculation was most rampant and most egregious are clearly coming down." She added that years of excessive risk-taking are coming back to bite them hard and predicted that the situation will devolve very rapidly. Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy argued that just as in the 2008 financial crisis, which stemmed partly from the federal government's push to ease credit standards in low-income communities, SVB's failure may have been fueled by politics. In SVB's case, a focus on so-called sustainable finance, or ESG, may have contributed to bad lending decisions, he said, adding, "When we don't learn lessons, history repeats itself." Billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman warned that SVB's failure may trigger runs on other troubled banks, causing a 2008-like chain reaction as the dominoes continue to fall. Meanwhile, New York Times noted the U.S. economy could quickly shed a million jobs and fall into recession if lawmakers fail to raise the nation's borrowing limit before the federal government exhausts its ability to pay its bills on time. The chief economist of Moody's Analytics, Mark Zandi, warned a Senate panel recently. The damage could spiral to 7 million jobs lost and a 2008-style financial crisis in the event of a prolonged breach of the debt limit, in which House Republicans refused for months to join Democrats in voting to raise the cap. Zandi and his colleagues Kristen Riritis and Bernard Yaros wrote in an analysis prepared for the Senate Banking Committee Subcommittee on Economic Policy. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, held the subcommittee hearing on the debt limit and its economic and financial consequences at a moment of fiscal brinksmanship. House Republicans are demanding deep spending cuts from Biden in exchange for voting to raise the debt limit, which caps how much money the government can borrow. That debate is likely to escalate when Biden releases his latest budget proposal. The president is expected to propose reducing America's reliance on borrowed money by raising taxes on high earners and corporations. But he almost certainly will not match the level of spending cuts that will satisfy Republican demands to balance the budget in a decade. The report also warns of a stark economic damage if Biden, in an attempt to avert a default, agrees to those demands. In that scenario, the dramatic spending cuts that would be needed to balance the budget would push the economy into recession in 2024, cost the economy 2.6 million jobs, and effectively destroy a year's worth of economic growth over the next decade, Zandi and his colleagues wrote. They said the only real option is for lawmakers to come to terms and increase the debt limit in a timely way. Any other scenario results in significant economic damage. The economy is very vulnerable, he added, saying, even without the debt limit drama, the recession risks are high. It won't take much to push us in, and this is certainly a lot more than much. Zandi's analyses are frequently cited by the Biden administration in support of its economic policy proposals. In this case, Warren is using the Moody's work to push Biden in a letter sent to the White House this week to resist Republican demands for spending cuts and instead continue insisting on a debt limit increase that is not tied to any changes in fiscal policy. Warren, in an interview, said everyone has been talking up to now about how dangerous it would be to default on the national debt, and that's right. But it would be even more dangerous to give in to the Republican cuts. The president has stood strong, and I urge him to continue to do that. Zandi's projections join a growing list of warnings from forecasters on Wall Street and at Washington think tanks about the consequences of failing to increase the borrowing limit in a timely manner. House Republicans have refused to raise the limit unless Biden agrees to deep but unspecified cuts in federal spending. They say the nation's current levels of debt, accumulated in bipartisan fashion over two decades of the federal government spending more money than it receives in tax revenue, pose a current and future threat to economic growth. The government hit its statutory $31.4 trillion debt limit in January. The Treasury Department is employing what is essentially accounting maneuvers that allow it to continue to pay all its bills on time. But those maneuvers work only for a third limited time. Independent groups like the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington and the Congressional Budget Office have estimated that sometime this summer or early this fall, the U.S. government will no longer be able to pay everyone, including bondholders, Social Security recipients, and federal employees on time. The Moody's team estimates that deadline, known as the X date, will fall on August 15th.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, says he wants to strengthen Israel's relations with Africa. But Netanyahu's ambition isn't reciprocated by African nations. This was evidenced at the African Union's annual summit in Ethiopia last month, when the Israeli delegate was ejected. Israel responded by claiming the African Union had been taken hostage by extremist countries. An Israeli spokesperson alleged that African nations like Algeria and South Africa were driven by hatred and were controlled by Iran. We'll be discussing these developments and Israel's response after this report by Latifa Abou-Chakra about Israel's record of interfering in African affairs.
Despite Israel's controversial observer status at the African Union being under discussion, diplomats from the Zionist entity attempted to enter a recent AU summit. They were promptly expelled from the hall by security. This took place in the same week it was revealed that a band of Israeli intelligence agents, called Team Jorge, had meddled in 33 elections worldwide, with two-thirds of those taking place in Africa. In the 1960s alone, Israel trained the military forces of African states like the Ivory Coast, the Central African Republic, Dahomey, Cameroon, Senegal, Togo, Tanzania, Nigeria, Somalia, Uganda, and Ethiopia. According to the Wall Street Journal, during the same period, the CIA funded Israeli foreign aid and Mossad operations in Africa to disguise their agenda. A key base of operations in Africa for Israel is the state of Ethiopia. Ethiopia's emergency police were trained by around 40 Israeli advisors. Ethiopia also gave the Israeli Navy the right to use two islands in the Red Sea to access the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. Israel even founded a commercial cover for Israeli intelligence operations in Africa called Encoda, which operated out of Ethiopia's exporting meat. It was a military operation that transported spies around the continent. During the same period, Israeli advisers saved Emperor Haile Selassie from three separate coups, according to General Metatiyahu Peled, a member of the IDF General Staff. A joint shipping venture between Ghana and Israel, named Black Star Line, kept a flow of hundreds of Israeli experts into Ghana and was rumored to be an intelligence operation. Even when relations with Israel broke off in 1973, Israeli intelligence had links with Ghana's secret service, so much so that the Ghanaian government later accused Israel of involvement in a coup attempt. The emperor of the Central African Empire, later to become a republic, Jean Bedel Bokassa, was accused of killing and eating his political opponents. His army was trained by the Israeli military, and his closest advisor was the Israeli general Shmuel Gonen. The former president of Congo, Mobutu Sese Seko, was trained in Israel, where he obtained his parachute wings. He later went on to lead the coup and killing of Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba. Mobutu then allowed Israel to train the first paracommando battalion of his army. He claimed to break relations with Israel in 1973, but Israeli agent Meir Meyuhas stayed on as his personal advisor, right-hand man, best friend, and business partner. In 1982, it was reported that Mobutu was personally paid $10 million for the reopening of an Israeli embassy. In 1983, he agreed to increase his presidential brigade to 7,500 soldiers who operated under Israeli supervision. In the 1971 coup that brought Idi Amin to power in Uganda, he was supported by both the MI6 and CIA. However, Colonel Baruch Barlev, the commander of the Israeli military delegation in Uganda, was deemed instrumental in the coup. A pattern is observed in African states where, while Israel may not have had official relations with them at the time, an Israeli agent is dispatched to become a personal advisor, right-hand man, or even best friend of the head of state. This theory has rung true in the examples of Senegal, Zaire, Liberia, the Ivory Coast, and others. Revelations around Team Jorge prove what we already know to be true. Israel is interfering in African affairs.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University. He's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest expert today is Miko Peled. Miko is a human rights activist and an outspoken advocate for Palestinian liberation. He was born and raised in West Jerusalem. His father was a general in the Israeli army, and his sister was good friends with Benjamin Netanyahu. Miko says that as one of the privileged people in Israel's apartheid system, he knows it's apartheid. His book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is a powerful account of his life. And his book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, details the unjust treatment of the five Palestinian Americans who were wrongfully convicted and imprisoned in the US for the crime of sending food and medicine to orphans in Palestine. And we spoke to Miko earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, this method of placing an agent close to the ruler is interesting, isn't it? I mean, do we know anything else about the ways in which rulers in the global south may be compromised?
Well, we saw lots of examples in the film there, but the other ones, which I think is interesting, is the use of honey traps by the Israelis. So in both Morocco and in Jordan, there have been cases where intelligence services have used women who've got close to the leader or soon-to-be leader in both of those countries, in one case having a baby with the king. That's been used as a method for gaining intelligence and potentially, we don't know the full story yet, potentially for controlling and influencing the government in Morocco and indeed in Jordan.
Lord. Well, a member of the Peled family was quoted in that report, so I asked Miko to tell us a little about his family's role in the development of Zionism in Palestine.
Well, my family members were instrumental in the establishment of the State of Israel in many ways. On my mother's side, my grandfather was a leader within the Zionist movement in Palestine. He was part of the pre-state Zionist government in Palestine, if you will, with kind of like an executive. And then he was a signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence when the State of Israel was established. On my father's side, his family were working class people, but they were building roads and they were doing all kinds of, developing the country in that way. And my father himself volunteered to be part of the Zionist militia when he was 16. I was still in high school, and he went on to be part of the ethnic cleansing, to participate in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. And then he remained as an officer in the Israeli military and retired a general after the 1967 war in 1968. But then he took a turn somewhat, and he, immediately after the 1967 war, he said, now Israel needs to stop fighting wars and start making peace, particularly with the Palestinian people. And that's really when the idea of the two-state solution, as we know it today, was invented. He and several other Zionists who had a little more foresight realized that if you're going to have two nations living in the same country, you're going to have, respect the rights of both sides. And he said, if we don't establish a Palestinian state and recognize the rights of the Palestinians to self-determination, then eventually there will be a binational state. It's either going to be an apartheid state or a democratic state, which means it won't be democratic and won't be Jewish.
David, what do you make of these front companies that seem to have operated in Ghana and Ethiopia?
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, so there's the using advisors very close to the rulers, and there's also the use of companies which appear to be fronts and which are used to cover spying operations. We know, of course, that the Offer family used their shipping company to transport Mossad agents into Iran, and it looks like there's been similar companies in relation to Ethiopia and possibly also in relation to Ghana, the Black Star Line company there, half owned by this very senior Israeli businessman who it looks like, since since he was, his company was then led by one of the Offer family, looks like was also used by the Mossad to camouflage his activities. One of the companies, one in Ethiopia, was pretended to be transporting meat. And of course, you know, what it was doing was transporting spies.
Right. Well, I also asked Amiko for his thoughts on the expulsion of Israeli diplomats from the African Union summit.
The whole issue of Israel being an observer in the African Union is absurd. I mean, after all the damage and the state of Israel has done to Africa, going back to the 50s and 60s, you know, Israel participated not directly in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, but then, you know, my father himself would travel to the Congo to train Mobutu, who was the dictator that took over. And Israeli advisors, so to speak, have been, you know, in Africa supporting the worst dictators and stealing African resources and enriching themselves for decades. So now Israel is somehow thinks it can be an observer in the African Union. It's absurd. So I think that was a good step that they kicked the bat of the opening session. But I think I would hope that the African nations stand firm and maintain this moral stance of not normalizing with the state of Israel.
David, a lot's been written about Mobutu's links with the CIA, but far less is known about his links with Israel. I mean, why do you think that is?
I think there's a number of reasons. I mean, I'm surprised by some of the stuff we've found out in the show today. I mean, the sheer number and variety of links and infiltrations that the Israelis have carried out, really not very widely known. Now, part of the reason for that is it's not been reported. But another reason, I think, is that there's an idea in the West, especially amongst the left, that if you talk about Israelis' foreign policy objectives, that somehow that you're delving into anti-Semitism, not just because you're talking about the Jews being active abroad, but because somehow, really, it's only the Americans who are engaged in imperialist activities. Now, what this shows, I think, is the need to start to think about the state of Israel as an imperialist power rather than a power which is underneath the power of US imperialism.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I then asked Miko about whether he thought the recently exposed Team George election meddling was an aberration, or whether there are likely to be other Israeli groups active in African elections.
Well, I don't have any particular news, but Israel has been in Africa, in all roles in Africa, doing what I believe is criminal work, supporting the worst dictators and so on. And so, again, I don't know specifically anything specific about that. I just do know that the role of Israel in Africa is deplorable, and the Africans should spit them out.
Well, we're going to return to our discussion in a moment after this report about the closeness of the Zionist entity to the worst forms of colonial exploitation in Africa.
The material bonds that existed between Israel and some of the most well-known colonial endeavors on the African continent are certain to be a significant factor in the relations between the Zionist entity and African states today. White Rhodesia is frowned upon today by many in liberal societies, but Israel has never been held accountable for its considerable role in maintaining white settler rule there. There were Israeli military mercenaries within the Rhodesian army, leading to at least one of them being killed by the resistance. In a move similar to the apartheid wall in the West Bank, a 500-mile wall along the border of Mozambique and Zambia was constructed by an Israeli company owned by a reserve general in the Israeli military, Abraham Orly, for the settler Rhodesian regime. Israel sold the regime large quantities of Uzi machine guns. The Israelis also granted Rhodesia the right to produce their own Uzis, nicknamed Ruzis. Israel also sold them helicopters through a clever arrangement that slipped through an embargo on arms exports to the settler colony. Israel voted against independence for Algeria from French rule, which is not surprising because, as few know, Israel was an active party in the conflict. Israeli intelligence services were working closely with the French in Algeria from at least 1954. Israel set up its own branch in Algeria called the Misgaray, which was found to be fighting alongside the French and killing Algerians on occasion. Israel also supported the secret French terrorist settler group, OAS, which assassinated French officials negotiating independence with the Algerians.
The apartheid-era Prime Minister of South Africa, Daniel Malan, was the first foreign prime minister to visit the Zionist entity following its invention. The first nuclear collaboration between the two apartheid regimes is believed to have taken place as early as 1955, the same year Israel exported the Uzi to South Africa. There's also evidence that in the 1980s, Israel was supplying the regime with drones. Israeli arms company Elbit Systems played a major role in creating a military electronics industry in South Africa. Hundreds of soldiers in the apartheid regime army graduated from Israeli military schools, and there were 200 Israeli military advisors guiding the apartheid army. Again, Israel was involved in erecting an electrified wall to police South Africa's border, with a band of 50 Israeli technicians who were based there permanently to maintain it. The wall was equipped with radar systems and minefields. Shabak, the Israeli secret service, had a permanent mission in apartheid South Africa. It is claimed that the apartheid intelligence forces' letterbomb campaign against ANC figures like Ruth Furse resulted from cooperation with Israeli intelligence, which was using similar methods against the PLO. Israel and apartheid South Africa collaborated closely on nuclear development, with uranium extracted from South Africa proving very helpful to the Zionist entity.
Hey David, what more can you tell us about Israel's role in Algeria?
Well, as the film showed there, the Israelis were involved. They set up this branch, the Misgaré, in Algeria, which fought with the death squads, the fascist death squads, the settler death squads, supported by the French, against the Algerian Revolution. So they were fighting on behalf of the French settlers against the liberation forces of the FLN in Algeria. And that's kind of what you'd expect. It's a settler colonial situation, and Israel, is on the side of the settlers in that circumstance, as it has been in many others.
Mm. Well, I asked Miko how close the bonds were between the Zionists and the apartheid South Africa.
Well, the two apartheid states were established around the same time, 1947, 1948. And they had close relations, very early on. And I remember as a child when John Vorster, who was the prime minister, came to visit. And he was, I think, during World War II, he was a Nazi. And he came to visit the State of Israel and was given, was presented with an honor guard with the Israeli military. And he was welcomed by the Israeli prime minister, who at the time was Yitzhak Rabin. And it was, even as a young, I was a young boy, I was maybe a teenager, and I was horrified, absolutely horrified. And so that relationship was back, and Israel was a staunch supporter. In fact, actually, the South Africans themselves were very proud to say that Israel, too, is an apartheid regime very early on. I think it was in the 60s. Major South African leaders were saying that Israel, too, is an apartheid state and, what a wonderful place it is. Those bonds were very, very tight and very strong. And unfortunately, I think today the South African government, even though they downgraded their relations with Israel, still maintains some relations with the State of Israel. But, we talked about the two-state solution and so forth. But, those bonds go back very, very long, very deep and very far.
David, that report implied that there was a link between Mossad and the boss agent's letterbomb campaign against the ANC. I mean, do you think that's likely?
It seems very likely. I mean, let's remember that Ruth Furst was married to Joe Slovo, one of the leaders of the South African Communist Party. Her daughter now is a novelist, lives in Britain. And she was killed with a letterbomb sent to her outside South Africa, I think in Angola. That is very much modelled on what they were doing in relation to the PLO and their assassination attempts against PLO and other resistance, Palestinian resistance members. So the kind of collaboration was deep, was long-lasting and multifaceted.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite incredible, though, isn't it, that there's such a kind of relationship exists, isn't it? I mean...
Well, you say that, but I mean, only if you think that the Israeli regime was somehow a left-wing socialist kind of experiment, which, of course, many of the early Labour Zionists did think. But no, I mean, it's a settler regime, and they were identify themselves with the settlers in South Africa, in Algeria, and indeed, of course, in what became Zimbabwe in the conflict in Rhodesia. They were identified very strongly with the settlers, the white settlers in Africa.
Well, there's even the suggestion, isn't it, that there's links between the apartheid regime and the ADL. I mean, is that...
Oh, the Anti-Defamation League.
Yes, Anti-Defamation.
Right, of course. I mean, the Anti-Defamation League, of course, which is an organisation set up, it says, to combat defamation against the Jewish people, i.e. against anti-Semitism, ended up spying on South African anti-apartheid activists, and indeed many thousands of other activists in all sorts of areas, and they were sharing data on that with BOS, the South African Intelligence Agency. So there's a very clear set of historical links there between what effectively... outgrowths of Mossad and the settler regime in South Africa.
Right, OK. Well, I then asked Miko for his thoughts on the assertion that Israel has entered a stage of naked fascism and whether the apartheid label sufficiently describes the reality of the current situation there.
Israel has always been fascist and apartheid regime for everybody but the Jews, and so that hasn't changed. What has happened now is that we have a less apologetic or a government that is completely unapologetic about killing and destroying Palestinians and Palestinian property and so on. But Israel has always been an apartheid regime from the moment it was established.
I mean, David, what do Israel's links with white Rhodesia, do you think, tell us about its affinities on the African continent?
Well, so we've already seen it in the films that we've been looking at, the relationships with South Africa, the relationships in Algeria, and the ones in Rhodesia, which became Zimbabwe, no different. Very, very close ideological affinities with settler colonial regimes. So that's, I think, clear. But what we have learned, I think, from this programme, which we didn't know before, is that also the involvement in literally 10 or 20 other African countries, with people being close to dictators or shipping spies into the countries. I mean, there's hardly any African countries, really, that the Israelis haven't been intervening in, which is really quite a dramatic thing to say. Mm. But the evidence for it is what we've given in the programme today. So I think what's interesting here is that you have, yes, a settler colonial regime which ideologically aligns with other settler colonial regimes, but they also, of course, want to align with or intervene with or subvert other authoritarian regimes, like, for example, the regime of Emperor Bokassa there, who thought of himself as a god on earth. Now, that relationship with authoritarian regimes is also something which they did across the whole of the continent.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Morocco is a particular case in point, isn't it, in terms of those links?
Well, in Morocco, I mean, they actually set up the Moroccan intelligence services, the Mossad did, and that allowed them to carry out various different operations in Morocco, including smuggling Jewish children out of Morocco on the pretext that they were going on holiday. And of course, what they were doing was they were effectively kidnapping them and taking them to Israel so that they could have more settlers.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to our guests, Miko Peled, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
Britain's economy has faced many challenges in recent years. The withdrawal of the country from the European Union and the expenses caused by the control of the coronavirus pandemic caused the economy to be about 20% smaller than in 2020. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, rejected calls to prevent sharp rises in domestic energy bills for all households in his March budget, meaning millions of Britons will see costs soar by about 40% from April. Instead, Jeremy Hunt will claim the extra support he's giving to the poorest and most vulnerable households, including those on benefits, in what he will describe as a more fairly targeted system of support. Demands for the Treasury to halt a planned rise in the energy price guarantee, the discounted cost of gas and electricity to consumers from £2,500 to £3,000 a year